All right, I'm going to start with some data. Talk's titled Data and Dogma on the Autism Epidemic. This is a chart of counts of children in California who are registered with the Department of Developmental Services. So the DDS in California is a state agency that provides real services for families and kids with developmental disabilities. So this is something that people want to be affiliated with. Their estimates at about 80% or more of kids with autism register, their families register them with the DDS. But these are administrative data, right? I mean, these are not research data. These are not, these are data that are kept for other purposes, for the purposes of maintaining the program. This chart, though, and actually an earlier version published around 1999, generated a tremendous amount of controversy and pretty much kicked up the debate over you know, the epidemic of autism in the United States. From 87 to 98, there's a 273% increase in these counts. Kids registered with this agency with classification of autism. And there's almost a doubling in the last 4 years in this update that was issued in 2002. You know, it generated a tremendous amount of attention and was replicated in other administrative data systems, such as special education data from various states. But these data, these are administrative data, and they have their issues. You know, first of all, these are just counts. There's no denominators here. The denominator of kids in California was, in fact, growing from 87 to 98, increased by about 25%, so it doesn't quite make up for that 273% increase in the numerator. And again, these are not the kind of information that epidemiologists, biostatisticians are comfortable with in terms of making an inference about a real increase in disease risk. So the dogma. So on the heels of this information and other information like it that came out, there's been some, you know, fairly strong statements made about the autism epidemic. These are a couple of books. They sort of reflect the two different dogmatic views, if you will. Evidence of Harm is a book mainly about mercury and vaccines. You're going to hear a great presentation on that topic next. But the opinion sort of expressed in that book, and I'm actually, the quote I'm going to use is not by David Kirby, it's by Robert F. Kennedy, who's actually written, co-authored pieces with David Kirby, and it came out in a Salon article at the time Kirby's book was released. Some skeptics dispute that the rise in autism is caused by vaccination, thimerosal-tainted vaccines. They argue that the increase is instead a result of better diagnosis, a theory that seems questionable at best. So the idea here, the dogma here, is that this thing is too big. You know, those are imperfect data, but this rise is too large, and there's just no way that it can be explained away by diagnostic changes. And it gets linked, this kind of dogma gets linked with concerns about toxins, in this case, vaccines, environmental causes. So Richard Grinker, in his excellent book published around 2007, sort of put forth the other dogmatic statement. Perhaps they don't want to give up on hope that if we can only find the cause of the epidemic, in quotes, we could help these children. If there was no real epidemic, we might just have to admit that no one is to blame. But we cannot find real solutions if we're basing our ideas on fake premises and bad science. So the idea underlying this statement is that, look, this is a behaviorally based condition. It's a diagnosis du jour. There's a tremendous amount of media attention. There's the need to get the diagnosis to get those services. And we know that these kinds of things can really blow up and can, in fact, create the increases that we saw on the in the previous data. And behind this is the idea that, look, we also know that autism is highly heritable. It's heritability estimates, though a tricky piece of statistical information, are you know, around 90% for autism, or that was what the thinking was in the late 1990s. So you know, if you're going to use data, if you're going to develop some evidence, what do you have to do? You have to try to develop some evidence that either supports the idea that you have a real change in risk underlying these data, or that what you're seeing is a function of changing diagnostic tendency. So first, what's been done with respect to a real change in risk, and how do we do this? Well, if we think that those counts are imperfect, why don't we, you know, measure real autism cases and get an idea of what the real change in risk is? So As opposed to administrative data, we could turn to what's been existing in the research literature. These are research studies, after all. These should be better data. And what I've plotted here are just the point estimates. I know this is a statistics section. Forgive the lack of confidence intervals, but they're hard to come by in some of these older studies. Basically, the size of the circle is just the size of the denominator, so a rough proxy for precision. The small points would be much less precise estimates. And what you see here is this notable trend over time, much more consistency in the early age of autism from the 60s through the 1990s. And then in the latter 1990s and early part of the 2000s, you see a couple of things. You see a lot more variation in estimates. And you know, if you're going to put a point, I don't know if I can point here, if you're going to put a point here in the center of this cloud, you know, you might infer that there's some sort of a trend here. But this variance is certainly of concern. Now, we saw some excellent meta-analyses in the previous presentation, and if there's a card-carrying meta-analyst in the room, they would you know, run screaming from those data. There's a tremendous amount of heterogeneity in these studies. This is a nice paper that looked at some of the factors. Those studies, different age group kids, different ways of finding the cases in the community, different ways of confirming the cases, different diagnostic criteria going on in the background. So that's the research data, and it doesn't really help us a heck of a lot more than the administrative data. So maybe you build new data, you build better data. And that's exactly what the CDC was charged to do by the Children's Health Act in 2000. They were charged to build the surveillance system for autism spectrum disorders in the U.S. Usually I have a loud voice. Can you guys hear me in the back? Hello, test, 1, 2. All right. So I'll lean in a little more. So in 2000, CDC was charged with building the surveillance system, and it was modeled off of the birth defects and developmental disability surveillance work that went on in Atlanta. It's a records-based surveillance system. So right now we've got 11 sites that are participating in this, in the ADAM network. And what these sites do is they have a geographically defined catchment area that has to have at least 25,000 kids age 8. We do surveillance on 8-year-olds, right? And what's done is under the powers that public health surveillance provides is we can bring together for those kids in any surveillance year their public school records and the clinical records from the major diagnostic providers in that catchment area. So these records are all reviewed, and we review a broad screen. So for special ed, it's not just the autism classified kids, it's kids with any special ed classification. And the ICD-9 codes on the clinical side include things like static encephalopathy and ADHD. So we look for those kids who might be mislabeled. The records are screened. If there's any sign that there might be a behavior consistent with autism, they're reviewed in great detail. The information is abstracted into this complex computer database. It's interleaved, and then each site has expert diagnosticians who review this data and make the call. So the ADAM system has generated enough prevalence data now that we have trend data from ADAM. These are ADAM prevalence estimates from 2002 and 2006. So right now the current average estimate for 2006 for ASD prevalence is 1 in 110. The prevalence in boys 1 in 70, and girls 1 in 315. We've seen an increase. As you see, there are 10 sites that have trend data, and each site has seen an increase. Pay attention to the tops of the bars. Those are the ADAM estimates. The darker blue shows what the prevalence would have been if we just counted existing diagnosis in the community by schools or by clinical providers. So look at the top bars. And those have increased across these sites between 27 and 77% from 2002 to 2006. Now, so is this it? Does this mean it's real? Well, the records-based system. We are at the mercy of what makes it into records and how rich those records are, and that can very well be changing in the communities, couldn't it? We look at a few things. We see that each of our sites get 2 more records each year, but that's not a big factor. But one of the things that's a potentially very big factor is the number of evaluations per kid. The average number of evaluations that we look at has increased from a little under 4 to a little over 5 from 2002 to 2006. So the richness of that data is very different just over this 4-year period. All right. So we built the data system. Is very good, but there are still real questions about whether or not this trend that we see is real or not. So maybe we can work on the other side. We can try to get some evidence to see whether or not we can support the idea that there's changing diagnostic tendency. So I'll go through some of the work that's been done in this regard. So the first thing you can do is you can just, you know, you can be thoughtful. You can think about what's gone on in the changing formal diagnostic criteria and informal factors over time. And this is, you know, complex, and I don't have time to go through this, but this tracks the different diagnostic systems that we're currently in the DSM-IV era. Starting in 2013, we're going to be in DSM-5, and actually big changes are afoot for autism in DSM-5, so that will be interesting. But you can see that the criteria for defining autistic disorder has changed to some extent. The core deficits in the three core areas of impairment have remained the same, but some of the way they're counted has changed. Big things that have gone on is categories have been added. A PDD-NOS category has been added with DSM-3 in 1987. That would capture kids who are less severely affected. So obviously it's going to bring more kids under the umbrella, but it's interesting to think about what the addition of this category does to this diagnosis. It's going to pull kids out. Kids who made it in the old system here into autistic disorder, are they going to be pulled out into PDD-NOS or Asperger's? There are lots of different angles on this, and it's complicated to sort out. There's been some comments on what to make of this, and sometimes we forget that DSM-IV was viewed as an attempt to rein back in what was becoming an expansive diagnostic system. So DSM-IV was designed to be tighter than DSM-3R. And there's a lot of parsing of language. You know, Morten Gerstenbacher wrote a very nice paper in 2005. You know, she makes a big deal of the fact that in DSM-3, a criterion is called pervasive lack of responsiveness, whereas in DSM-4, it's a lack of spontaneous seeking to share achievements with other people, and says that, you know, there's a huge shift there. You know, maybe not. Tough stuff to figure out just by thoughtfully looking at this language. So what else can we do? We can conduct studies where we apply diagnostic standards of one era to samples from cohorts coming from another era. I'll show you what I mean here. So this is the first time this was tried, and this was actually tried in that 2002 report that generated those California counts that I started to talk with. So this is just a cartoon showing the thinking of what these guys did and a little problem that they had. The top's an older birth cohort, and the bottom's younger kids, you know, more recently born kids. If we think of, and this is an oversimplification, of autism as a continuous phenotype, and we say that in the old days, right, you would have to have impairment above this level to be called a case, right? But let's say that the thinking is that in the new days, this is the younger birth cohort, remember, we're now a little bit more expansive. So we're going to make the call for kids who are a little bit less impaired. So what Bird and colleagues did is they were trying to get at this. And so what they did is they took the current gold standard diagnostic approach and confirmed diagnosis in the kids who were called in the California DDS system, autism, in the younger birth cohort. They confirmed it. And they found, you know, they were able to confirm about 90%. And then they said, well, let's take that and apply it to the older kids. And they said, look, you know, we confirm 90% as well here. Things haven't changed. But obviously, you would expect to catch a good proportion of those kids, right? Because if your gold standard is now formed to recognize kids under this new conception, this broader conception. So that was a little bit of a problem with the approach they took. But others have done things that are a little bit more reasonable. Tony Charman did an interesting thing. He took about 140 kids who were identified from a population-based prevalence surveillance system over in the UK. He took 60 kids who had autistic disorder, 60 kids who had other ASDs, and 20 kids who screened positive but were not confirmed. So these were kids, you know, were a little hinky developmentally, but they didn't meet criteria for ASD. And this is a modern cohort. And then what he did is he said he trained a group of folks to implement 1966 diagnostic criteria. And he validated their approach to doing this with Lorna Wing, Susan Bryson, people who were around back in the day. And they got trained up, and they were supposedly implementing this as a clinician would back in 1966. Now, of course, can people forget all their biases? Can they really do this? But, you know, they had some quality checks and seemed like it was working. And they found that of these modern era autism cases, those 80 kids, 80% of them were confirmed with the old criteria. So what do you make it? 20% of them weren't, but 80% of them were. I think they were a little surprised that it was that high, quite honestly. Bishop, another UK group, published this study, which was a very small study, but kind of interesting. They were looking at diagnostic substitution in the other direction. They took kids who participated in studies of language impairment back in the day, work that they had done previously, who were now 15 to 30-year-olds. And when they enrolled in these language impairment studies, they were ruled out for autism. So then what they did is they took the modern diagnostic gold standards and applied it to these kids, and it was, I think it was just about 40 kids or so, and found that of the 40 kids, only 13 did not meet diagnostic criterion, today's diagnostic criterion for autism spectrum disorder. Right? So that's showing some expansion of diagnostic criteria with respect to these higher functioning kids who were previously called language impaired in the old days. What else can we do? Statistical analyses of existing administrative data at the group and individual level. So this has also been sort of a rocky course. The first try here was done by Crowan and colleagues, and they took again that California data, and they looked at for a birth cohort born in 1987, an older birth cohort and a newer birth cohort born in 1994. They looked at prevalence of autism and MR. In 1999, and they found that for autism, prevalence was up, and it was down for the same amount for mental retardation. And this was sort of a strong case that there was a lot of diagnostic substitution going on. But what they forgot is that the average age of diagnosis of MR in kids is much older than it is for autism. So the younger birth cohort wouldn't have had enough follow-up, right, to pick up the MR diagnoses. So when they redid things, looking at cumulative incidence at four years of age, they found autism going up, but MR was staying flat. So this was not as strong evidence for diagnostic substitution as they first cut at it. This is a little something that we did. We just looked at special education data, some cohort graphs. On the left is autism, and you know, obviously you can't walk through this, but you can see that if you look at the color goes from, on the autism graphs, the youngest cohorts are on top, the oldest at the bottom, so the difference in those cohort curves is the expanding prevalence of autism. MR, the trend is in the back, in the opposite direction. Not quite as big, because I've got these things scaled equally, but it's in the opposite direction. So some group level evidence for diagnostic substitution. All right, I'm running short on time, but I want to mention this Bierman study. It's a very complicated model-based study of the California data. He took 7,000 kids with autism prior to 1987, so this is an older cohort again. And he considered events in this group, the 600 or so of them, who had an autism diagnosis but had previously had an MR diagnosis, right? So these are kids who switched. And he predicted the odds of that switching. And he was very interested in period effects when things were going on, like the movement to DSM-4, some things that were going on with California diagnostic standards. And he found some large period effects. The problem is they don't make a tremendous amount of sense. You wouldn't expect there to be a spike right at the year the DSM-4 was introduced, and then it dropped down in the following year. And there are some things with the California-specific period effects that don't make a lot of sense. Then he went on, though, and took this model and did what he called a thought experiment, which was a lot more complex modeling that I don't have time to explain. And he basically tried to estimate how many cases, newly occurring cases, how many additional cases from 93 on were attributable to this diagnostic shifting from MR to autism. And he estimated about 25%. But he was very cautious about this. He was more interested in these findings, in his previous findings, but in the period effect findings. But this is, of course, what gets talked about in the media. So I'll skip this piece on age at diagnosis, and I'll come up with leave you with some closing thoughts. So data on the secular trend of true autism risk that's invulnerable to diagnostic bias just doesn't exist. Data documenting some non-trivial diagnostic effects, diagnostic bias, does exist, and this isn't surprising. We would have guessed this just thinking about things. Precise, valid data that quantifies the full extent of diagnostic bias, it doesn't exist. You can't come up with a single summary saying that all of the increase we see in any one administrative source is due to some compilation of diagnostic phenomena. This can't be done. So there's still plenty of room for dogma, and people are still in these two camps. Now, so I want to leave you with this. So what's the public health urgency of this situation? You know, we really would like to know if real risk is going up. You know, that's one thing that epidemiologists are interested in, to point to an, you know, possible environmental contributor. But what's going on with the whole other side of autism research and on the genetics front is that the genetics of autism are complex. And not only are they highly complex, but some things like de novo copy variants and epigenetic mechanisms, things that are very environmentally influenceable, right? Those are becoming sort of the things of most interest. So long story short, even without evidence that supports the idea that there is a real risk increase or a significant component, there's a lot of attention being paid to environmental risk factors in autism today anyhow. So, thanks. Scott. Scott, in the California, there was a brief period of time in California, that DDS data around 2005, where it looked like it was going to level off. And interestingly, it actually matched with around the time period where kids who would have been in the post, who would have been after thimerosal came out of vaccines, right? They would have been that, those cohorts would have been the groups that were affected. But it picked right back up. Yeah. No, there really hasn't been that work, and I've been very interested in talked to the folks involved in the ADAM network of wouldn't it be great to try to capture that in the same communities where we actually do the ADAM surveillance. Take clinical vignettes, videos of kids, and survey parents, general pediatricians, expert diagnosticians over time to see whether or not their reaction, what they would do, how alarmed they are, would they refer, whether those behaviors actually change over time, and empirically track that kind of data, but nobody's really done that yet. All right, thank you.